This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The reasoning behind it was that the Saudi government was trying to address jobs and keep people busy, which would keep them from maybe wanting to overthrow the government. So they decided that they were going to subsidize wheat growing. Now, of course, this sounds insane. You know, in Saudi Arabia, growing wheat.
With drought-stricken California enjoying its wettest winter in decades, it can be easy to forget that water scarcity is among the globe's most deadly threats. This week on Sea Change Radio, we discuss groundwater with Bill and Rosemary Alley, the authors of High and Dry, Meeting the Challenges of the World's Growing Dependence on Groundwater. They take us on a journey around the world and back in time to examine how humans scheme for and squander Earth's most precious resource. We talk about wildcatting for water in the 19th century, India's water management quandary, and some of Saudi Arabia's more imprudent water policies. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rosemary and Bill Alley. They are the co-authors of High and Dry. Rosemary is a science writer, and Bill is a hydrologist. Rosemary and Bill, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good morning. Nice to be here, Alex.
Nice to be here, Alex.
So you two have actually worked together in writing a book about nuclear waste, but this High and Dry is about groundwater. What was the inspiration behind the book?
Well, we wrote the book for two reasons, actually. And of course, the big one is Bill's, much of his working life background is in groundwater. But our primary purpose was to raise awareness about groundwater. Most people don't realize that over 95% of the world's unfrozen fresh water is groundwater. And it's just amazing what groundwater has done for the world. It's farmers have job security because they're no longer dependent on, you know, praying for rain. Groundwater has created this agricultural revolution that the world has never seen until pumping of groundwater. Groundwater is insurance against droughts that used to result in mass starvation, and it's also a key pillar of urbanization. Supplies drinking water to many of the world's megacities. It's their total drinking water supply. So with all this at stake, you'd think that we'd be taking very good care of our groundwater resources, but the opposite actually is the case, that groundwater has become critically endangered both in quantity and quality. So it's a big water world out there. There's a lot of people working in that world, hydrologists, water managers, and engineers, and policymakers. But in most cases, groundwater is barely on the radar. And another issue is that there are many laws governing surface water, but in most places, there aren't even basic safeguards to protect groundwater. I think of groundwater as the neglected child of the water world. So Bill and I have talked about this, that, you know, part of the reason that groundwater is so neglected is it's out of sight and out of mind. And there's a strong analogy with climate change, that it's hard to get people to understand the seriousness of a problem when it develops slowly and you can't see it. And there are also huge misconceptions about groundwater.
Such as?
You know, we think 95% of the world's unfrozen fresh water sounds like we've got it made in the shade. But this statistic is misleading. A lot of this groundwater is too deep or it's otherwise uneconomical to pump, or it can't be developed without causing problems such as land subsidence or stream flow depletion. And some of it's just too contaminated for human use. And so we also wrote the book for to try to reach a wider audience. And of course, if you want people to read a book, you have to make it interesting and enjoyable. So we did this by telling stories.
Yeah, and I want to dive into some of those stories, actually. We've covered a lot of groundwater-oriented things on Sea Change Radio, and usually it deals with the Southwest and California, Arizona, Colorado. and the high plains. We dealt, of course, with a lot of aquifer issues when we covered the Keystone XL pipeline. So I would want to give it more of a human face if possible. One thing that I didn't realize was that there was kind of a wildcatting period for groundwater exploration in the 19th century in Australia and Texas. Why don't you, maybe Bill, perhaps you can give us some examples of this. It kind of predated the oil boom, but it was kind of similar in the methodology, wasn't it?
Sure, yeah. So you had a lot of wells that were artesian, which means when you drilled a hole in the ground, the water had enough pressure that it just spurted out at the top, at the land surface. And, you know, people really didn't have any idea where it was coming from. Some people thought it was coming from the Great Lakes or there was a huge water body underneath, and they just let these things run just like they would a geyser, literally flooding the streets of some towns like Fort Worth and others. And of course, that pressure died off pretty fast, and so there aren't nearly as many artesian wells that you can find today. So that was really kind of part of the early days. People also didn't have the ability to drill like they do today, or the irrigation systems that we have today, or the pumps. You know, it was relatively limited.
But some of these drilling efforts were really cutting edge for their time, like in the 1840s in Paris, for example.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so it took them years to drill that well, and the one you're referring to in Paris, and they finally hit an artesian aquifer and had a huge gusher on their hands.
You said it went up like over 100 meters high or something?
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have that kind of pressure in our populated regions in terms of groundwater anymore, or do we?
You know, we really don't. So a lot of areas, even in California, you had people could go off the coast of Southern California, could literally dip their buckets in the water where fresh water was coming into the sea because of the pressure on groundwater. So it's,
and they'd drill and drill until they'd get these gushers.
Yeah, they drill until they hit. Basically, that what they did is they hit an aquifer that was confined by a low permeability unit above it, and the water was entering the aquifer at a higher elevation, so it had a lot of pressure, and there was no release of the pressure until you actually drilled through the confining unit into the aquifer.
Now, all groundwater is not created equal. Maybe you can explain which types of aquifers are more renewable and less renewable than others.
A lot of the problems worldwide, and one of the things we really tried to do with this book is to take a world view of groundwater, because there really isn't anything like that out there. And so worldwide, you have a lot of aquifers in the Middle East, in North Africa, and then, of course, in parts of the southwestern United States where the water is what's known as fossil water. In other words, it was put there tens of thousands of years ago in a wetter climate. And so when it's just like mining, unless you can recharge it somehow today, it's just like mining oil or something like that. Once you use it up, it's gone. And so that's a major problem in those parts of in some parts of the world. In other places, I mean, like you have what's known as karst aquifers, like in Texas, in the San Antonio area, which is, they're almost 100%, for a while they were 100% dependent upon this big aquifer that was just almost like an underground reservoir because it had all these cracks and fissures and solution channels in the carbonate that water flowed rapidly through. And so, you know, it would go up and down almost in the same kind of periodicity that you would see a surface water reservoir. So they're very different. That's one of the things we've tried to convey. In fact, we had a whole chapter on it in terms of just how different groundwater systems are. It's just not like a single body of water underground, but the same everywhere.
Wind on up, high and dry. Gonna kiss the moon goodbye. Thank you.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Bill and Rosemarie Alley. Their book is High and Dry, Meeting the Challenges of the World's Growing Dependence on Groundwater. So, Rosemarie, maybe you can give us a sneak peek at the beginning of the book where you talk about some of the more amusing ways that people have tried to get water in the past. Praying for rain has been one of the oldest parts of civilization and religion in some ways. But can you tell us about Charles Hatfield? He seemed like quite a character.
Well, he was. And, you know, there were all these various approaches to try to get it to rain because that's what people were dependent on for a long time. Hatfield was, you know, the deal with the rainmakers, and there were a whole series of rainmakers back in the early 1900s. But the idea was to get rain but not get too much. And Hatfield, he had some real success in L.A., said he'd get a reservoir full by, I don't know, in a few months, and he did it. And, you know, he became quite the rainmaking hero.
When you say he did it, what did he actually do?
He had this tower he would build, and then he would mix up his secret formula, which was just a bunch of who knows what, and then let it age, and then put it up on top of this tower. And someone commented at one point that it rained in self-defense, that the stuff smelled like a Limburger cheese factory. But he got rain a lot. He would do this, you know, build this tower and put these chemicals up there, and it would rain. So he was hired in San Diego back in the early 1900s. There was a serious drought in San Diego. And they said, well, we'll pay you $10,000 if you fill up, oh, I don't know, a couple of the critical reservoirs by December. And so it was just a simple gentleman's agreement. They all shook hands. And within a few weeks, he had the reservoirs overflowing. And it was just, I mean, it was a disaster. Railroad lines were being washed out, homes, there was loss of life, roads were being washed away.
But when you say he was totally a snake oil salesman. I mean, this was,
exactly.
Right? This was not like he did anything to make this. It just happened to rain a lot after he, so he kind of got lucky, but then he got too lucky. Is that right?
It was a huge coincidence. Let's put it that way.
Right.
But, you know, who knows? I mean, I'm sure some people believe in this stuff, but at any rate, it was quite the coincidence. So he's calmly demanding his fee. Of course, most people wanted to lynch him, and they finally said, okay, you know, we'll pay you if you will be liable for all the property damage. So this thing dragged on in court for a couple of decades and finally was dismissed on the grounds that there was no written contract.
Now, I'd like to focus on some of the countries that we haven't really spoken about before on this show. And one of them, I was surprised to learn, soon to pass China as the world's most populous country, as that's India. Now, India is largely dependent upon groundwater. And as this population bulges in a landmass, which, as you note, is a third the size of the U.S. or China, it's a real recipe for disaster. Maybe one of you can speak to kind of giving us a brief overview of what's happening in India with its groundwater situation.
So India pumps a quarter of the world's groundwater. It's an amazing amount of water, groundwater that they pump. And it's actually, lots of times we think of India as a wet country because we think of the northern part with the Himalayas and the Ganges and lots of water. But a lot of it is very dry, depends on monsoons. It's kind of like a little bit like California in that sense.
So does it get its groundwater from the Himalayas?
In the northern part, but most of the groundwater recharges is coming from precipitation that comes.
I see.
From year to year, and a lot of the country is actually hard rock, so it's either a Precambrian rock or it's a huge basalt flows were in India. So the water, it's not a great aquifer, not a lot of space for water like a nice sandy aquifer would be, and as it happens. You know, the farmers in India were subsidized for their electricity. And so they got many of them free electricity or just a fixed price for whatever they pumped. And this created kind of a no incentive to conserve conserve water, and it causes, and then you had all the farmers banding together in, you know, special interest groups, and so there was no politician that could really take on trying to control this thing. It was known as the silent revolution, actually, where millions of farmers were suddenly putting pumps in the ground and starting to pump. Well, you know, today water levels are falling. It's just not a sustainable system that they've got going. So they're trying to figure out how to turn the situation around. And we cover a couple interesting stories. One where they took an entire state in India and rewired it so that one set of wires went to the cities and people's houses, and another set of wires went to the farmers' pumps so they could have some control over the situation. Because farmers were literally, because they were having energy problems too. In fact, we start out the chapter with the big energy blackout that occurred in India, probably in part, if not totally, due to the farmers. And they were just literally leaving their pumps on, so when the electricity came on, the pumps would flow. It was just very wasteful practices, and they're still trying to get a handle on it over there.
The basic thesis that we're seeing from a lot of these countries where they're struggling to supply enough water for their population is, it brings me back to a book that I read by Yuval Harari, Sapiens, where one of his general theses is that man became domesticated by wheat, and not the other way around, that we became kind of slaves to this agrarian lifestyle. And when I read the chapter about Saudi Arabia, Harari's concept really sprung to mind. It seemed like a very poorly designed policy decision in the 70s in Saudi Arabia to become a self-sufficient wheat producer. Why don't you explain what happened?
The reasoning behind it was that the Saudi government was trying to address jobs and keep people busy, which would keep them from maybe wanting to overthrow the government. So they decided that they were going to subsidize wheat growing. Now, of course, this sounds insane. You know, in Saudi Arabia, growing wheat, you know, from the air, you can see these photographs in areas like Saudi Arabia or the arid southwest, where you've got these green circles on an otherwise just desolate desert. But in the process of becoming self-sufficient in wheat, within a few years, they became the world's sixth largest exporter of wheat. In the process, they managed to deplete this huge aquifer. They were sitting on top of fossil water, but one of the world's great aquifers pumped it down. So they finally shut down the wheat growing, some years ago, but they still have a very vigorous agricultural industry with vegetables, fruits, and dairy. And again, they're exporting dairy products. But of course, cows, just even in a cool climate, a dairy cow will drink up to 50 gallons of water a day. Saudi Arabia doesn't have a cool climate. I mean, the coolest months of the year, in December and January, the temperature is in the low 90s. Much of the year, it's well into the hundreds, even gets up into the 120s in the middle of their summer. So, of course, those dairy cattle are drinking huge amounts of water. Just makes no sense.
Give us an idea of the time as well. This is what, like the early 70s to the early 90s?
I'm not sure exactly when they peaked out their wheat production. It's really only within the last few years that they've actually just completely stopped any kind of subsidy of the wheat production.
I see.
But what happened is they don't have a lot of rivers in Saudi Arabia, as you might imagine. So their water supplies depend on desalination or groundwater. And they depleted more groundwater than any other country on Earth by a long stretch in terms of their fossil water. So they're number one in terms of depleting fossil water.
But so this was kind of a short-term, as you said, a short-term preservation move by the government, now that you explained that they didn't want to be pushed out of power, so they had to kind of provide some services to the people, similar to what Gaddafi did in Libya. It was a very expensive undertaking, and to try to deliver water where the groundwater was inland to where the population centers were on the coast in Libya. But so these short-term policies to try to stay in power lead to long-term problems when it comes to self-sufficiency, it seems like.
Right. It was very, it was like, we're talking decades that this took place, and essentially they depleted water that was recharged over thousands of years in a couple decades.
Yeah, if I could just add that, and recently, because of their dairy industry, they've started buying up land in Arizona. They've bought up a couple of very huge, very large pieces of land to grow their alfalfa and their fodder to feed the cattle. And this is called water grabbing, you know, where you go to another area and grow your, you know, your produce or your whatever, and then ship it back home. So this is raising some huge red flags in Arizona right now, that two large areas have been bought up by the Saudis.
Water, water, rising all the time. Wading through these streets, what used to be my home. All I had is gone. Tell me, won't you tell me, Lord, what shall I do? Got family here and there, but I don't know where. All I had is gone. Truly.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Bill and Rosemary Alley. They're the co-authors of High and Dry. It's a book about groundwater. So you have a chapter entitled Who Owns Groundwater? And at some point you also write, groundwater is a democratic resource. What did you mean by that?
Okay, it's surface water. You either have to be near a stream or a canal in order to tap the surface water. Okay, but because groundwater is available most everywhere, not everywhere, beneath the land surface, you can be anywhere and drill a hole in the ground right on your property. And that's what we meant by democratic. So a lot of people have access to it.
What puts groundwater at the greatest risk when we assemble some of these human elements? A lot of people know about fracking and how it puts groundwater at risk. Do you see that at the top of the list, or is that just a small example ultimately?
Fracking is an issue. I mean, oil and gas operations are an issue related to groundwater quality, but I certainly wouldn't put it at the top of the list.
What would be at the top?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about depletion or contamination.
Contamination.
It turns out that actually natural contaminants, arsenic, uranium, are amongst the ones that exceed health standards the most in wells. And then I'd say from a human point of view, probably nitrate is the most common contaminant. Now that's from fertilizer, but also from septic tanks. So where people have septic tanks, they can contribute a considerable amount of nitrate to groundwater locally. And then there's a whole range of toxic substances that one worries about. Those tend to be more localized, but they're very serious where they occur. And there's always new contaminants emerging. So for example, the contaminant du jour, if you will, for today is PFAS, which is something that was used in firefighting foams and on your furniture to make it waterproof, and making Teflon pans. And it's been used for decades, and suddenly we find out that it's very persistent. EPA has a very low criteria for its health effects in drinking water, and everybody's trying to figure out, you know, how much is out there and how you deal with it, because it's not easy to treat either. So there's always a new contaminants coming in to play, as well as the old ones. But in terms of general, you know, most pervasive problems, I would say they were nitrate, naturally occurring contaminants, and also pathogens are always an issue, even in groundwater.
Now, when we look at some of the countries such as Saudi Arabia and other very arid places, we always think, well, why not desalination? That's one solution. But ultimately, where do you see the best solutions coming from in terms of preserving our groundwater?
Well, there are two areas that are actually fairly new on the horizon. And one is what's called managed aquifer recharge, where you have to have the right geology to store water underground. But there's some real advantages as opposed to surface reservoirs where you have such a high rate of evaporation. So there are states, particularly in the Southwest, are turning to managed aquifer recharge. There's a fair bit of it in California. Arizona has amazing programs going. And but then there's probably the biggest area of meeting water needs of the future is recycling water. And this is where you take water, you clean it up, and you reuse it. Now, opponents of recycled water call it toilet to tap. And that has become a very effective campaign in many areas. You know, there's this formidable yuck factor with that idea. But anybody who, unless you live at the headwaters of a stream or a spring or whatever, everybody's drinking recycled water. I mean, you know, a town or a city uses it, they clean it up to a certain standard, dump it back in the river. You can clean water to an amazing degree. In fact, in Orange County in California, they clean the water to such a level that it's so clear, it's like distilled water. They have to add minerals back to it. So there's a number of cities in the Southwest that are really starting to get building capacity for recycling water. San Diego is one of those cities.
So one has to distinguish between direct and indirect recycling. So the direct is what Rosemary referred to as the toilet to tap, where you're actually treating water to the level that it can be drunk. And then indirect is where you kind of have a separate set of pipes, and they might do something like irrigate lawns and things like that. For example, St. Petersburg, Florida has a very large recycling plant that they send water through this entirely separate system to irrigate people's lawns, anybody that was willing to sign up for it.
Well, it's a fascinating read. It takes a scientific topic and makes it much more accessible to all of us. I highly recommend it. It's called High and Dry. The authors are Rosemary and Bill Alley. Rosemary and Bill, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Alex. Our pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Kenny Burrell and John Coltrane, Fog Swamp, and Eric Bibb. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.